This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning, everyone. Nice to be here again. So, 4 days ago, I know those of us belonging to... So I know that those of us belonging to East Asian lineages of Buddhism celebrated the Buddha's awakening 4 days ago on December 8th. And since I would be talking today only a few days after that, I decided to share with you a passage from the book that I wrote, which just came out last month. No, actually middle October, so 2 months ago now, which talks about the Buddha's awakening, at least in one of the early chapters. So I'd just like to share my rendition of that event. As a matter of fact, the temple that I belong to, the San Jose Nichiren Buddhist Temple, we're not celebrating Bodhi Day until tomorrow because we kind of push all of our celebrations to Sunday when everybody can be present together. So before I read the passage, I will explain what this is. This is Lotus in a Sea of Flame. Not this past summer, but the summer of 2014, my sensei, the Venerable Gyosho Matsuda, asked me if I would write a biography of the founder of our lineage of Nichiren Buddhism for the 35th anniversary of the San Jose Temple, which was held this past October. So that's not a lot of time. But he gave me these two very thick sheaths of notes, and I did what I could with it. I had a lot of help also from Dr. Stone, Jackie Stone from Princeton, who very kindly went over the manuscript and fact-checked it for me. What the book is a fictionalized version of the life of the founder Nichiren, who was a monk in the 13th century in Japan. And the passage that I would like to share with you is my imagining of what he, as a 13-year-old boy in 13th century Japan, would have imagined about the Buddha's awakening. And I based it also on passages from Ashvaghosha's Buddhacharita, which he might have been able to read in Chinese translation, passages from the Lotus Sutra, the Flower Garland Sutra, and also I did cheat a bit and use passages from the Pali Canon, which... because unfortunately we don't have English translation of the Chinese versions of the same material. So using what I had, I came up with the chapter about the awakening of Shakyamuni Buddha, and I would like to share with you maybe the last half of that, where he sits beneath the Bodhi tree. So without any further ado... the time had come for Siddhartha to realize his ultimate aim. He recalled a day in his youth when he sat beneath the rose apple tree in a state of calm abiding and clear awareness. He decided to again sit in the shade of a tree and reflect upon life in such a state of calm centeredness. After regaining his health, he went to the base of a fig tree near the town of Gaya. There he sat upon a mat made of grass. He crossed his legs in the full lotus posture, with each foot resting upon the opposite thigh. His hands rested in his lap, left hand atop the right, with both palms up and thumb tips lightly touching. He held his body erect and his head straight, so that nose and navel were aligned. He set an unwavering gaze upon the ground before him. Then he spoke the following vow: "Even if the flesh and blood in my body dries up, and only my skin, sinews, and bones remain, I will not arise from this seat of meditation until I attain supreme awakening." Siddhartha's bold declaration aroused the ire of Mara, the devil king of the sixth heaven, for he knew this was no idle boast. Siddhartha was no longer seeking the attainment of heavenly bliss or the acquisition of supernatural powers such as the other yogis sought. Instead, he was using the power of his years of yogic discipline to sit upright in direct awareness of the actual state of conditioned phenomena, beginning with his own mind and heart. If not stopped, Mara knew that the bodhisattva who was Siddhartha would soon achieve his aim. Mara quickly summoned his beautiful daughters to tempt the bodhisattva back to a worldly life of sensual pleasures. As Siddhartha sat, they each danced in turn, while those who were not dancing accompanied with drum and flute. They wore black silk caps, and their hair hung down to the ground in a ponytail. They were the model of courtly beauty, with white, powdered faces, rouged lips, and blackened teeth. They had even plucked and shaven their eyebrows and smudged in new ones on their foreheads. They wore bright red baggy trousers, white overrobes with long sleeves, and jeweled swords hung at their sides. In their hands they carried fans to gesture with as they danced. They danced with languid, graceful motions and sang of midnight trysts in darkened rooms, whispered secrets, passionate embraces, and the longing of hermits for lost loves and opportunities that may never come again. After the dancing and singing, they sat by Siddhartha and chatted quietly. Coy glances and inviting smiles were cast in his direction, but the bodhisattva did not respond. Growing bolder, they sat around him, offered him tea, brushed him with their sleeves in passing. They used every artifice they knew to entice the prince turned ascetic into rising up from his grass cushion to embrace them. Siddhartha was not moved. He had seen all this before while living in the palace. Yes, there might be some pleasure to be had with these heavenly maidens, but he saw it as nothing more than a lure, and behind the lure, the hook that once embedded would drag him back into the world, where all ended in the infirmity of old age, debilitating sickness, and ultimately the funeral pyre. He did not even look up at the daughters of Mara as they began to weaken, sag, and transform into wrinkled hags. Their delicate songs turned into sneers and shouts of outrage and bitter scorn. They withered, died, and fell in heaps upon the ground. Flesh decayed and fell away, leaving only dry, scattered bones. These turned to dust that the wind carried away. Not a trace was left. Mara resorted to brute force. His army rode in from all sides in full battle regalia. They wore full lamellar armor. Their helms bore golden horns or antlers, while their face masks bore the visages of fierce beasts, with whiskers, manes, snouts, tusks, and fangs. The expressions of these beasts were myriad, faces full of craving and lust, doubt and deceit, wrath, outrage, arrogance, confusion, fear, and even boredom and torpidity. Mara's demons carried longbows taller than themselves, and arrowheads for disemboweling foes filled their quivers. At their sides hung long, gently curving swords for closer fighting. The legion of demons surrounded the bodhisattva for as far as the eye could see. Once again, Siddhartha was unmoved. Even when the demons shot clouds of arrows at him, or brought forth catapults and hurled boulders or balls of flame at the bodhisattva, he remained still. As they hit the shade of the tree, the missiles transformed into flowers and floated harmlessly to the ground. The army vanished, leaving behind only fallen cherry blossoms. Out of desperation, Mara himself appeared and challenged Siddhartha, saying, "Who are you to think that you can leave my realm of desire?" Siddhartha did not speak or even look up. He simply reached out to place one hand upon the ground. The earth itself was his witness that there was nowhere in present and past existence where he had not sacrificed himself in previous lifetimes for the sake of the liberation and awakening of all sentient beings. Mara could do no more. He faded from sight. Now that all of his distractions, doubts, and unconscious inhibitions were cleared away, Siddhartha just sat beneath the fig tree with a clear yet alert mind. Memories came unbidden into the field of his awareness. In the first watch of the night, he recollected all the events in his present life that had enabled him to just sit beneath that fig tree on that particular night. Then more memories came, swimming up from the depths of his mind. Memories of other lives, not all of them human. These seemed to him to be memories from countless prior lifetimes when he had cultivated the qualities of generosity, morality, patience, energy, meditation, and ultimately, wisdom, that every bodhisattva must perfect in order to attain Buddhahood. Reviewing these memories, he saw how his life was shaped by the flow of causes and conditions, the most direct and important being those causes he himself had sown, nurtured, and brought to fruition. In the second watch of the night, Siddhartha's awareness took in the lives of all sentient beings. He saw them dying and being reborn, only to age and die and be reborn again, treading the same ground over and over as they traveled on the paths of suffering. He saw hell dwellers burning in their own rage and self-destruction, hungry ghosts tormented by their own unreasoning craving, beasts thoughtlessly devouring and being devoured, asura demons submerged in their own pride and pettiness, humans undergoing birth, aging, sickness, and death, inevitably meeting the agreeable with attachment and the disagreeable with aversion, longing for what is ever out of reach, and finding in every moment transition without surcease. And finally, the gods, complacent and serene until the day when their celestial robes become soiled, their garlands begin to wilt, beads of sweat appear, the stink of mortality rises up around them, and in a deadly gloom they fade from the heavens to be reborn in the lower realms. The Bodhisattva became a silent witness to the suffering of all these beings as they were driven by their deeds to express their natures in each and every one of these six paths of suffering, whether the obvious pains of the hells or the false promises of the heavens. Finally, in the third and final watch of the night, the Bodhisattva contemplated the chain of causation itself, whereby all things come into existence and all beings forge their own destiny. He saw that all sentient beings were suffering within samsara, the cycle of birth and death, trapped by their ignorant pursuit of selfish desires. Siddhartha realized that all suffering was due to a misapprehension of the nature of reality. In the constant flux of conditioned phenomena, there was no one and nothing to hold on to. Grasping at anything, even trying to find a fixed being standing apart to do the grasping, was nothing but an exercise in futility. It made no sense to demand of life what it could never give. So, he let it all fall away. Free of selfish craving and the ignorance that it was based on, Siddhartha knew that he would no longer be subject to the mental anguish of the paths of suffering again. As the night came to an end and the morning star rose into the dawn sky on the 8th day of the 12th month, Siddhartha awakened to the true nature of reality. From that moment on, he was Shakyamuni, the sage of the Shakya clan. As one who could now come and go from the realm of truth, he would also henceforth be known as the Tathagata, meaning both thus come one and thus gone one. The Buddha considered, who can be so wretched as to not show gratitude? Who in the present deserves praise and reverence for enabling me to attain perfect and complete awakening? For innumerable lives he had attended on hundreds of thousands of billions of past Buddhas, but in the present life there was no one who had been the equal of the Bodhisattva in wisdom and merit. Therefore he concluded, very well, I will praise the wonderful Dharma itself, for that has always and ever been my guide. Brahma, the god who believed he was the creator of the world, appeared, coalescing from the dawn light. A heavenly entourage that included the four heavenly kings, Chakra Devanam Indra, and the gods of the sun, moon, and stars accompanied him. Even Maheshvara, the great freedom god from the highest of the heavens of the realm of form, came to observe. Brahma praised Shakyamuni Buddha, saying, all the Buddhas of the past, present, and future, who remove the sorrows of sentient beings, abide in devotion to the wonderful Dharma. This is as it should be. Any who desire the highest good and aspire to awakening should reflect on the Buddha's teaching and likewise devote themselves to the wonderful Dharma. For 3 weeks after that fateful morning of his awakening, the Buddha stayed by the fig tree, which would later come to be known as the Bodhi tree, the tree of awakening. Most often he just sat and gazed upon the roots of the tree. Other times he walked about, reflecting to himself, the wisdom I obtained is most wonderful and excellent. The living beings wandering among the six paths of suffering are too dull, attached to their own pleasures, and blinded by stupidity to be able to understand or appreciate it. How can I possibly share what I have awakened to with them? Brahma and the rest of the heavenly host were still present. They joined their hands together, palm to palm, and bowed respectfully. Brahma, speaking for them all, said, venerable sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dharma. Let the Fortunate One teach the Dharma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes that are falling away because they do not hear the Dharma. There will be those who will understand the Dharma. Of course, every bodhisattva vows at the outset of their taking up the path to Buddhahood, I will cause all living beings to attain the same awakening that I aim to attain. Shakyamuni Buddha had done the same. Upon hearing Brahma's request, he looked upon all beings with compassion. He thought to himself, how sad and strange, all these beings already have the nature of Buddhas, but they do not see it because they are blinded by their greed, hatred, and ignorance. Yet there are some with only a little dust in their eyes. Some beings are submerged by delusion, others are about to emerge from it, and others have already begun to emerge. These beings are like a pond of red, white, and blue lotus flowers. Some of the flowers are still submerged in the pond. Others are just below the surface, and yet others have risen above the muddy waters and are about to bloom. The Buddha determined that he would teach all those beings using his vast store of skillful means to mature them and enable them also to realize Buddhahood. To Brahma in the heavenly host, he responded, I have appeared in this defiled world just like all the other Buddhas. I will expound the Dharma according to the capacities of all living beings. Now is the time to do this. So that is my version of the Buddha's awakening and what happened immediately after. Let's see how we're doing on time. Usually end at 11, right?
Ish.
Yeah. Maybe I could share another passage here, and if there's time, then I can take some questions if anyone has any or comments. This other passage I would like to share is when Nichiren, as a boy, he's about 16 or 17, goes to the city of Kamakura, where the shogunate had its headquarters, and he studies Pure Land Buddhism, the Pure Land Buddhism of Honen there, and he also said he studied Zen. He doesn't say who he studied with, but in later years he often mentioned Dainichi Nonin, who had lived about 40 years before, 40 years before, 50 years before. Dainichi Nonin was a mail order Zen master, by which I mean he studied on his own, and he sent two disciples with a poem he wrote expressing his awakening back to China to a Zen master there. The Zen master approved the poem, wrote out a certificate of transmission and a portrait of himself, and sent it back to Japan. Dainichi Nonin was very popular at the time, apparently. And even after he died, apparently many of his followers were keeping his so-called Bodhidharma school alive. But as perhaps many of you know, a lot of his followers went to study with Dogen. And then also the Rinzai, more credible Rinzai masters from China, were coming in, fleeing the Mongol invasions. So he's not too well known anymore. And we really don't know exactly what he taught, except for things that Nichiren said, and also Eisai wrote, criticizing him. So I'm in this passage here, it's about Nichiren's meeting with Zen as he encountered it, and I based all this on things that he wrote in his letters, and I put them all in the mouth of a sort of a disciple or grand disciple of Dainichi Nonin. That way, no real Zen masters will get blamed for any misunderstandings. But I would love to share this with you and get your impressions of Nichiren's impression of Zen. So, skipping all the exposition part. And Nichiren's name at the time was Rencho. So Rencho is his name when he was, before he took the name Nichiren at the age of 30. Rencho, curious to find out for himself what Zen had to offer, sought out one of the successors of Dainichi Nonin and asked, since I became a monk, I have studied the sutras in an attempt to discover the Buddha's true teaching. Some regard the Lotus Sutra as the highest teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha, but others say it is too profound and that we should entrust ourselves to the other power of Amitabha Buddha by chanting Nimbutsu as is taught in the three Pure Land Sutras, so we can be reborn in the Pure Land of utmost bliss, and only there will we be able to awaken to the truth. What is the view of the Zen school? The Zen master shook his head and smiled. He said, all the sutras are like a finger pointing to the moon. which is useless after seeing the moon itself. Those who attach themselves to mere words are like a hunter who once caught a rabbit when it collided with a stump, and who then keeps watch over that same stump, hoping that it will happen again. Instead of being caught up in words, you should look directly into the mind. Such things as heaven, earth, the sun and moon, all stem from the mind's delusions. The pure lands throughout the universe are just shadows of your greedy mind. Shakyamuni Buddha and his emanations manifested in the worlds throughout the universe are just variations of your awakened mind. Our great master Bodhidharma, without using words or other skillful means, transmitted this Dharma of Zen, which is a special transmission outside the sutras, not founded upon words and letters. By pointing directly to mind, it lets you see into the true nature, and thereby attain Buddhahood. Even sutras such as the Lotus Sutra, to say nothing of the Pure Land Sutras, do not reveal the true intent of the Buddha. If you want to truly awaken to the truth, do not cling to mere words and doctrines. Densho still had his doubts, however. Do you really mean to say that I should disregard the sutras, even the Lotus Sutra? Even the Lotus Sutra is no more than a finger pointing to the moon, while Zen is the moon itself. After grasping the moon, there is no need for the finger to point it out. Zen is the heart and mind of the Buddha, while the Lotus Sutra is merely his words. When the Buddha finished preaching all the sutras, including the Lotus Sutra, he held up a flower, and Mahakasyapa alone understood and smiled in response. The Buddha said, "I have the treasury of the eye of the true Dharma, the wondrous mind of Nirvana, the gate of the wonderful Dharma that in its true form is formless. Without setting up scriptures as a separate transmission apart from the teachings, I pass it on to Mahakasyapa." As proof of this transmission of the Zen teaching, the Buddha further entrusted Mahakasyapa with his kesa, which was then handed down through the 28 patriarchs of Buddhism in India and to the first 6 patriarchs of Zen in China. 28 patriarchs? I had heard there were only 24 patriarchs in India. The last was Aryasimha. Why do you say there were 28? Oh, yes. There were actually 4 others. Bodhidharma was the last Indian patriarch, and it was he who came to China in order to bring the practice and teaching of Zen during the reign of Emperor Wu, the Liang Dynasty. Well, that may or may not be, but still, I do not understand how you can presume to be a teacher of Buddhism if you reject the sutras. Apart from the sutras, how else can you come to know and practice the teachings of the Buddha? If you reject the sutras, you are rejecting Shakyamuni Buddha. I'll interrupt here to say this is exactly Dogen's criticism of some of the Rinzai extremists in his day and Shobo Genzo. So here, Nichiren and Dogen seem to converge on a few points. But as I said, the views being presented here are views taken from Nichiren's letters, which I believe were based on those of Dainichi Nonin's disciples. So, it is not that we reject the sutras, for we too recite and study the Descent into Lanka Sutra, brought to us by Bodhidharma, as well as the Diamond Sutra, the Heart Sutra, the Heroic Mark Sutra, the Perfect Awakening Sutra, and others. However, we know that all they can do is indicate the truth. Mere words and letters cannot hope to contain it. Trying to grasp the truth through words, thinking that the answer is in some verbal formulation, is as futile as a dog barking to drive away a thunderstorm, or a monkey trying to grasp the reflection of the moon in a pond. Without the guidance of a Zen master, the sutras will only mislead you. The words of the Buddha are like a wisteria vine hanging on the branch of a pine tree. What happens after the pine falls and the wisteria withers away? Shakyamuni Buddha entered Nirvana more than 2 millennia ago, and his teachings are disappearing and have long been misunderstood. What then shall people do? What we can do is look into the direct source of the Buddha's words, this very mind and body that are none other than the one mind of the Buddha. So you are saying that the Buddha's teachings can no longer help us, that Shakyamuni Buddha is no longer present to assist us? The Zen master chuckled and gestured to a statue of Manjushri Bodhisattva in the center of the meditation hall, before which were offerings of water, rice, incense, and candlelight. We practitioners of Zen also take refuge in the 3 treasures and present offerings to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. We recite the sutras, dharanis, and mantras, but we do not look to these things for awakening. We do not look to anything or anyone but our own direct realization of mind, for that alone is the way to meet the true Buddha. Come to know the true Buddha behind all the appearances of Buddha, one must be able to walk on the head of Virachana Buddha, the Dharma body. more than a little put off by such irreverence, Densho nevertheless continued to question the Zen master. "Very well. Let us say I wish to learn the Zen teaching. How should I begin?" "Well, if you are a practitioner of the highest capacity, then you would know that there is nothing to seek, nothing to cultivate, nothing to gain, and nothing to lose. You could abide in non-abiding, and know the true nature of mind, which is no mind. Most, however, are of lower capacities, or they are beginners who have not even fully cultivated virtues, such as generosity, morality, and patience, let alone the ability to sit still and allow, even if for a moment, the delusions of their own false thinking to subside. For these, such as many of the samurai who come here to take the precepts and become lay practitioners, we use the words of the sutras and provide straightforward instruction in how to sit upright and maintain awareness of the breath. For those of intermediate capacity who have progressed beyond such preliminary guidance, or of some innate ability, we advise them to contemplate one of the koans, or precedents of the past Zen masters. By contemplating these stories, one can get beyond all words and false thinking and awaken to one's true nature. For instance, a monk once asked Zen master Zhaozhou, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming to China?" Zhaozhou responded, "The oak tree in the garden." "There, you may sit with that one, in fact, and so begin your own practice." Densho was nonplussed. "That's ridiculous. You say the sutras cannot communicate the Buddha's teaching, but then you say I should contemplate the oak tree in the garden? Why should I cling to those words instead of the words of Shakyamuni Buddha? I am sorry, but I do not think this can be right. I do thank you for your time." Densho bowed and hastened away from the presence of the Zen master. The strange riddles and outrageous impieties of the followers of Dainichi Nonin could not possibly be the right way to discover the true meaning of Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings, he thought to himself. And with that, I will close. Thank you for allowing me to share those two passages with you. I look forward to any comment or questions or anything you might have. Yes?
Question. Kamakura period in Japan seems to have been totally unique in such an outpouring of creative departures from what was standard Buddhism. Ichiren and Dogen and all of those guys. Can you say a little bit about what was going on to support this huge change?
I mentioned a lot of this in my book. As a matter of fact, I think my sensei was a little astounded when he was thinking I was going to write a little 120-page novelette, and instead I come out with this monstrosity here. And a lot of it is trying to explain what was going on in that time, why Nichiren felt the need to do what he did. Several things were happening at once. One is that up until that time, Buddhism was not for the common people at all. It was purposely brought in as, some people say, a superior form of magical technology for the imperial court, basically to hold these very lavish rituals and ceremonies for the protection of the emperor and his family and the nobles and for Japan as a country. And in fact, the early laws forbade the monks from going out to teach Buddhism among the people. They did it anyway. But it wasn't until Honen and Shinran in the late 1100s that people started trying to share accessible forms of Buddhism with the common people, like simply chanting Namo Amida Butsu. So that was the beginning of the Buddhist mass movements. And Dogen didn't quite participate in that aspect of it. But there was another thing going on as well that Dogen was a part of, as well as Nichiren and Honen and Shinran, which was that the Tendai school and also the Shingon esoteric school had become the Buddhist establishment in Japan. And that had been going on since the 9th century. And those were very complex schools. They're more like umbrella schools, especially the Tendai. There's a Shingon tended to concentrate just on esoteric practice, but Tendai was an umbrella that took in the Oxhead, I believe, Zen school, esoteric practices, the precepts, especially the Bodhisattva precepts, that today the 16 precepts you take in Zen, the 10 of those are the major precepts of the Brahmana Sutra. Of course, the study of the Lotus Sutra itself, you know, all of these things, Nembutsu practice, Pure Land practice, it was all part of Tendai. And I think that by the end of the 12th century, people were feeling a need to find what is the essence of all this? What is the most important thing? How can we not get distracted and lost by all this? And so, of course, Dogen focused on Zen. Honen and Shenron focused on Pure Land. Yinchen focused on the Lotus Sutra itself. Another thing that was going on was that the Taoists and Buddhists and Confucians in China were playing this game of one-upmanship of, you know, whose sage came first. And they came up with these totally bogus dates for when the Buddha was born and taught, like something like 960 BCE or something like that. I forget the exact dates, not important. But the point is that there were prophecies in the sutras that the Buddha's teaching would only last in its full authenticity for 1,000 years, and in the second period, it would be the period of the counterfeit Dharma, when people were kind of practicing, but they weren't really getting it. And then after that first 2,000 years came the period of the latter age of the Dharma, where the true spirit of Buddhism would be forgotten, people would just fight with each other over the teachings, things would be at best superficial, and this period would last for 10,000 years, and then the Dharma would be entirely forgotten, and then the world would have to wait for Maitreya to come and start the Dharma wheel rolling again. And according to these bogus dates of the Buddha's birth and death, the latter age of the Dharma, this third period, when Buddhism would begin to decline hopelessly, started in the year 1052. So that meant that everybody was basically looking for a way that Buddhism could still work, even though the prophecy said it doesn't work anymore. And then the last thing that happened was that the power of the imperial court collapsed by the middle of the 1100s, middle of the 12th century, and the samurai, the warriors who were supposed to take care of these outlying estates, basically came into the capital and took over. And the first shogun, well, not crowned, but, I don't know, entitled, declared, was in 1192. So that was the beginning of the so-called Kamakura shogunate. Mm-hmm. So basically what you had was several hundred years of relatively peaceful civil rule by the emperor and the court, and now become a military dictatorship. And then it wasn't even the military dictators who ran things, it was the regents, the Hojo regents. So it's a very complicated and distressing political situation. And a lot of people, especially people in Kyoto and the court, like Dogen and his family, Honen and their family, were, you know, feeling the shock waves of this. So they felt like their whole world had been turned upside down, and the Buddha Dharma doesn't work anymore, and now we're hearing that these people, the Mongols, are taking over everywhere, and they're going to come for us. And also there was a little mini ice age going on in the world at that time, so there were a lot of problems with the seasonal unseasonal changes, I should say, which created a lot of famine, plagues, droughts. So they felt like the world was coming to an end, basically. And so this created this kind of existential crisis in people like Nichiren, who, you know, they wanted to figure out what can we do? What can we do as an individual? What can we do? And Nichiren in particular was focused on what can we do as a society to save ourselves, to make this world into the Pure Land that it's supposed to be according to the sutras. So anyway, so that answer took a little longer than I expected. Any other questions or comments? Are we doing on time? We're doing good. We have about 6 minutes. No other questions?
So then I'm wondering if we can apply it to the situation in the world today where there are a number of religions that seem to be becoming more and more extreme. So, you know, actually, this is the truth, and if you don't get it, you're you're hopeless. You have to accept it. Have we learned anything in 700 years?
No.
Why not?
I don't think. Well, no. Well, some people have learned something. You know, not Colbert. James Fowler wrote a book called Stages of Faith. That's it. And you know, he looked at the work that Piaget did on child development and Kohlberg on moral development, and he saw that this seemed to apply to the development of our religious sense. You know, from a very naive kind of magical thinking focus to a much more universal, benevolent outlook that has faith commitment, but sees that, you know, my belief may not be the only one. So it's, you can hold it seriously but loosely, if I could put it that way. And you know, I think there are more and more people beginning to have a more mature faith perspective, and whether that's, you know, going to be sustainable and spread out to other people remains to be seen. One thing I really like about the Lotus Sutra is it teaches the one vehicle whereby all the Buddha's teachings, and even maybe the teachings that preceded the Buddha, Nichiren certainly believed this, that Confucianism and Taoism were also steps, all flow into the one vehicle leading to Buddhahood. So with that kind of teaching, there's this idea that everyone can be a Buddha. Everyone is on the way to Buddhahood. Everyone should be treated as a Buddha in the making. And so I think if that kind of thinking prevails, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be with the Buddhist labels necessarily, but if that underlying kind of faith in our common humanity can spread out more. You know. But the other thing is, for that to work at all, people have to lead a dignified life. They have to have, you know, dignified work. They have to be able to take care of their families. They have to, you know, expect that they'll be able to, you know, live year to year without starving or being bombed or having some deadly disease sweep through. There's so much instability in the world still that, you know, to talk about these kind of things, whether or not one can attain Buddhahood, is really academic. You know, when you're starving to death, or, you know, the government's dragging people away in the middle of the night and torturing them. And so much of that goes on all over the world, and that's why we see such desperation and rage. I don't even think it's not primarily motivated by religion, but then religion comes in and just kind of aggravates the situation and gives people an ideology to fight for. You know, maybe if I fight for God in this way, it will save us. And as a matter of fact, the thing about my book is I present Nichiren as he presents himself in his letters, and he kind of goes off too far himself at times, and I'm not trying to hide any of that. I present him just as he is in the context of his time, so it could be understood. So in a way, this book's very influenced by my reading of James Fowler and also William James' Varieties of Religious Experience. And this is kind of my attempt to show, well, here's another example of someone's religious experience. Yes?
I wanted to, if you could comment more on the last exposition you did around sort of Nichiren's understanding of Zen, because it seems to be indicating sort of a validation that of my limited experience here of that Zen is not an intellectual understanding of mind and heart, but it is the experience of the experiential, of just being in that moment that meditation offers the clarity to then enlighten your daily practice, and then that daily practice then, of course, then influences and informs meditation, and it's all that cycle of the study of the sutras, and it all works together. But unless you... It's hard, where words fail us, that clarity of in the mind and heart when you are sitting then sort of informs everything else.
Well, the thing is that, I mean, there's a little irony here that, you know, Zen talks about not being scholarly, but focusing on practice, and yet there's huge amounts of writing done by Zen. But and then the other thing is that I think especially well in East Asian Buddhism, you know, the Zen Buddhists talk about, you know, there's those of us who practice meditation, and then there's all those scholarly Buddhists, and that's a false division, really. All Buddhists should be practicing Buddhists, and even the so-called great scholastic schools like Tiantai was focused on meditation and practice. So all forms of Buddhism are at their most authentic level about practice, about experiencing practice. Unfortunately, human beings being human beings, most people are armchair Buddhists, no matter what school they're in. You know, so you have the Zen Buddhists reading through all their koans and books about Buddhism, but how often do they actually sit? You know, I've heard even in Japan, you know, very few, even of the Zen priests, actually do a sustained sitting practice.
With that, I need to use the bathroom. Where is
it? Oh, it's upstairs.
Okay, thank you.
Behind the kitchen. So, you know, it's... but the thing is that what Nichiren is encountering here, again, is kind of a sort of an extreme form of Rinzai, I'm imagining. And even Zen, even Nichiren in some of his later letters differentiated between different types of Zen, those that seemed to reject the sutras completely, and those that took more of their cues from the sutras, and then there was some other type he differentiated. So he was basically like reporting what he saw. He never mentions Dogen. He doesn't seem to have heard of him at all. And what's even more curious is I can understand that. Dogen was way up in, where is it, Echigo?
Echizen.
Mm-hmm. What I don't understand is he barely mentions Eisai, and Eisai was much more well known. And Eisai was, like Dogen, a Tendai monk, and he founded and was in charge of many very important temples in Kyoto and even Kamakura. And yet, he never says one word about Eisai in his letters, and I just don't get that. But, yeah. Yes?
Some people seem to think that one of the characteristics of North American Zen is kind of a lay orientation, even if you take priests, because they have jobs and whatnot.
Right.
And also maybe a second of a kind of a syncretistic creeping in of various things.
Mm.
Others. And I wonder if you think the same thing about Nichiren Buddhism.
What, that it's syncretistic?
Well, that it's...
Lay-oriented?
Lay-oriented, or because North America is exerting a lay influence on it.
I see what you're saying. Actually, I have a very long paper on my website, on my blog about that. What I discovered in researching that paper, I presented it at a conference a few years ago about adapting Asian Buddhism to America, was that in the late 19th century, the Japanese government said that it was going to stop enforcing the rules for the Sangha that made sure that they didn't drink or eat meat or get married, things like that. Basically, up until that time, the Tokugawa shogunate enforced these rules, and the new Meiji government said, that's on you guys. If you want to be celibate, you know, not drink and wear robes all the time, that's on you. You police yourselves. And a lot of people, including in the Nichiren school, were outraged by this. And what, within a generation or two, you had Japanese Buddhism the way it is today, which is all the priests marry and pass their temples down to their sons, and there is really no monastic Buddhism in Japan at all. And by the time Japanese Buddhism started coming over here in the late 50s, early 60s, like Shunryu Suzuki, it was that form of laicized Buddhism. And the reason the Meiji government did this was they were trying to destroy Buddhism. They were actively trying to get rid of Buddhism entirely from Japan. That didn't work. So
it was a foreign teaching?
Exactly, right. You know, we should all be Shinto. We don't need that foreign nonsense from China and India. It didn't work. Buddhism is too ingrained in the culture. And even though a lot of people lost respect for the clergy because they were no longer monastics, they continued on. They still had their social important social function. Another group, though, in Korea, the One Buddhists, who were founded around 1916, purposely had their clergy able to marry, purposely created kind of a lay movement. And a lot of the new religions, other new religions in Japan and Korea, were lay-oriented. And I think that these people recognized that the old monk-oriented Buddhism is just not going to fly in the new modern world. Mm. You know, and I don't know, I have ambivalent feelings about that. Mm. But it's not because it came to America that Zen or Nichiren Buddhism is lay-oriented. That happened in Asia. And it might be good for us. Maybe it's good for us that there's not this fixation on, you know, celibate, monastic, elitist practice. I just recently read a book by an anthropologist who was studying Buddhism in Burma in the 1960s, and I did not like what I read. I don't think that kind of monastic-oriented Buddhism has much to offer us based on my reading of that. But that's a whole big other topic. On the other hand, I'll end my comment on that with this. I do think we need a group of people who are more or less full-time practitioners who can maintain centers like this one for other people who are not able to be full-time practitioners to, you know, be able to come in and practice at. So whether they're, you know, monks or married clergy, I think it would really benefit Buddhism in Europe, America, well, everywhere, to always have like a core group of full-time practitioners, facilitators for all the practitioners. Not just my thought. Thanks. Do we still have time? It's 11:07.
One more?
Okay. Anyone else? Okay. Well, thank you very much for listening, and that's it.